Good evening, you're listening to The Truth Tank, and I'm your host, The Tank. If this is your first time listening to The Truth Tank, a big welcome. If you're a repeat listener, welcome back. Alright, I'm not going to waste any time tonight, we're just going to get straight into the episode. This episode is a continuation of Godzilla Part 1. On the last episode, we looked at the latest installment of the long-running Godzilla franchise, and that is 2023's Godzilla Minus One. We also looked at some of the themes and issues of the film, such as disaster response, national identity in post-war Japan, and people helping people. On this episode, we're going to have a look at the backstory and history of Godzilla, such as how he got his name, the various films in the series, and the different eras of the Godzilla films, which stretched back multiple decades, going right back to the original film that kickstarted the franchise, 1954's Godzilla. Then, on the second part of the show, we'll be having a look at the truly incredible, terrifying, and completely unbelievable true story that helped inspire the Godzilla franchise. And that is the story of Lucky Dragon Number 5. It's one of those stories that if you put it into a movie, no one would believe it, because it's so over the top and truly unbelievable. You couldn't possibly imagine something like this actually ever happening in reality. If you want to know more about Lucky Dragon number 5, I guess you're just going to have to listen to the end of the show. So without further ado, this is episode 54 of The Truth Tank, Godzilla Part 2, Backstory History, and the true tale of Lucky Dragon number 5.
Sharks of the corn? Virus shark? Cocaine shark? Sharktopus? Yeah. Those are all real movies. Join me, Steve Coates, as each week I take a comedic look at the bizarre world of sharksploitation cinema on Bucket of Chum, the Shark Movie Podcast.
Right, so done with the reviews. Let's move on and have a look at the backstory, history, and influences behind Godzilla. So what's the backstory behind everyone's favourite movie monster? The first Godzilla film came out in 1954. He has appeared in movies, TV shows, animation, comic books, novels, video games, you name it, Godzilla has done it. The themes behind Godzilla are pretty clear. Nuclear radiation, nuclear weapons, the balance of nature, and military might. Godzilla is full of metaphors. Some have suggested that it's a metaphor for the United States, a giant beast awaking from its slumber to wreak vengeance on Japan. Godzilla's origins, depending on what version of the story you go with, tend to differ a little. Sometimes he's a giant, prehistoric, dinosaur-like monster that was awakened by the nuclear tests. It's also one of the few franchises that has multiple films made by different studios in different parts of the world. The Western rights are owned by Legendary Pictures, aka the MonsterVerse, and the original Toho Studios. Godzilla first made his cinematic debut in 1954. There has been an incredible 38 films, 33 Japanese, and 5 American, starting with Sonyzilla in 1998. James Bond's got nothing on Godzilla. What are the Bond films up to now? I think it's like 23 or 24. So not even Bond can hold a candle to the amount of films that Godzilla has been in. So this brings up the question, where did the name of Godzilla originate from? You've probably got a pretty good idea of what the name Godzilla means. Godzilla is a hybrid of two Japanese words, Goria, meaning gorilla, and Kujira, meaning whale. No one really knows the origin of the story behind the naming of Godzilla. There's varying accounts, but the legend goes, one of the employees of the studio caught the eye of the film's producer, Tomoyuki Tanaka, who observed the worker and gave him a nickname, Gojira. I'm guessing this guy was a husky gentleman. He must have resembled a gorilla. So the name Gojira seems to have stuck, and that was combined with the Kujira whale. Gorilla whale. Several other people at the studio have backed up the story, but it is disputed. Either way, it makes a good story, even if we don't find out the origins of the name. Godzilla also has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. I saw that when I went to LA nearly 10 years ago, back in 2014. Pretty sure I knew that before I went there, and I deliberately sought out Godzilla and King Kong, I'm pretty sure. I don't think I found King Kong, I only found Godzilla. Over the years, Godzilla has gone through a few different incarnations. He has a very interesting history and has appeared in several different eras of time and film. The backstory and messaging of Godzilla are pretty clear. It's more or less an allegory for the nuclear bomb or the hydrogen bomb and the consequences of nuclear radiation and what these weapons are capable of. But little did I know, it was inspired by several real life events, one of which being the mysterious story of Lucky Dragon number 5, which we'll get into a little later. Godzilla has been around for a very long time. He has existed in multiple eras. His first appearance is 1954, which was 10 years after World War II, so that goes back a very long time. He's been around for nearly 70 years. 2024 marks the 70th anniversary or birthday of everyone's favorite giant lizard. The first era of Godzilla, or Godzilla films, was known as the Showa era. This lasted from 1954 right down to 1975. The Showa era gets its name from Emperor Showa, who was literally the Emperor of Japan. He was the 124th Emperor. He reigned from 1926 right up until his death in 1989. So the Showa era kicks off the classic period of Godzilla, with the first film Godzilla, as I mentioned, being released in 1954. It also gives us some of Godzilla's most iconic foes, such as King Ghidorah, the three-headed dragon-like monster that is one of Godzilla's greatest enemies. It also introduced us to Godzilla's adopted son, Minilla, and the iconic Mechagodzilla. This era is also responsible for introducing the world to Rodan, Varan, and Mothra. Toho Studios also produced several spin-off films with Godzilla universe-connected characters. Marvel wasn't the first studio to give characters or villains their own TV show or movie. There are about 5 spin-off films featuring Godzilla monsters such as Kumonga, Baragon, Gorosaurus, Manda, and Angarius. And as I mentioned before, this is the era before computer-generated effects, so some lucky or unlucky person had to don the iconic Godzilla costume and portray everyone's favorite giant reptile. The honors went to a man named Haru Nakajima. He portrayed Godzilla from his first appearance on screen in 1954, right up until 1972 when he retires, handing the reins over to several different stuntmen who took over in his stead. It wasn't all fun and games either. He used to sweat his ass off every day. He'd pour sweat out of the gloves and feet of the costume. He would stay in it for all day, which would have been hot as fuck. He also got several injuries. The metal reinforcements in the rubber suit would wear through the thin layer of rubber on the inside and cut and chafe his skin, which wouldn't have been fun. So this brings us down to the second era of Godzilla, the Heisei era, which went from 1984 to 1995. This is an era of Godzilla revival. Toho Studios reboots the franchise with the return of Godzilla in 1984, which marks the first in the second era of Godzilla films. Return of Godzilla is a direct sequel to the 1954 original film and does what a lot of franchises do today. It completely wipes the slate clean and disregards everything that has happened in the previous movies after the original. So this isn't something new. Franchises have been doing this for a very long time. It's most likely continuity. They probably didn't anticipate the film becoming as popular as it did, or producing the number of sequels spanning various decades. What the Heisei era does is set out a singular timeline and tries to create a sense of continuity between the original and the other films. It also takes him back to his roots as being a destructive force that is the peril of humans. It also goes into biological science and genetics a bit more and starts to get a bit more scientific in some of its themes. It also tries to fix Godzilla's origins by giving him a set in stone origin story, so there's no more loose theories floating around about Godzilla's origins. Is he a dinosaur? Is he not a dinosaur? Or is he just a gigantic mutated lizard that happened to wander into a nuclear test zone? So in the film Godzilla vs. King Ghidorah, which came out in 1991, these questions are answered. Godzilla is an ancient dinosaur called Godzillasaurus that becomes mutated after coming in contact with nuclear radiation. So more or less sticks to the theories that most people thought were the origins of Godzilla, but gives it more definition and sets it in stone. And this brings us down to the current era, known as the Millennium Era, beginning in 1999 to 2004. It's not as long running as the previous two eras. This is also a time of reboots and reincarnations of Godzilla. The first film to kick this era off was 1999's Godzilla 2000 Millennium. It was a Japanese production. This era focuses more on standalone stories than interconnected sequels. The 1954 film serves as the main point of reference for the entire era to keep with continuity. There's a bit of a gap between 95 and 99. In between those years, we get Sonyzilla, Hollywood's Godzilla, the 1998 film, affectionately dubbed Sonyzilla, comes out the previous year in 1998. So it doesn't quite fit, and rightfully so, it doesn't really deserve to fit alongside the other Godzilla films. It's kind of its own thing. That's one of the more modern attempts of Hollywood trying to make a Godzilla film. There were a few films planned for the 80s, I think. There was a couple that had entered like the storyboard stage of development, but didn't go much further than that. There's also a King Kong vs. Godzilla movie from the 70s or very early 80s. I always try to find that movie when I was a kid. Every time I'd go to the video shop, I'd always look for King Kong vs. Godzilla. Kids at my school would always talk about it, but I could never, ever find it. This kid in my school used to talk about it all the time, and he used to talk about it and he'd tell everyone, like, basically scene for scene what happened in it and got everyone excited, but no one could ever find it. So I started to doubt this film ever existed. But turns out it does, I just could never find it. And to this day, I've still never seen the original. So in 2004 comes Godzilla Final Wars, which also marks the 50th anniversary of the franchise. Not a lot else happens in the Millennium Era. And after the final film in 2004, Toho Studios undergoes some changes and pauses making any more Godzilla films for about 10 years. And this brings us down to the Reiwa era from 2016 to present. And this is the age of evolution and rebirth for Godzilla. 2014 is a big year for Godzilla. Toho Studios announces plans for a new Godzilla film set to be released in 2016. And this turns into Shin Godzilla, the highest grossing Japanese Godzilla film. This is also a time where Hollywood is also taking a renewed interest in Godzilla. Gareth Edwards' Godzilla comes out in 2014 and is a big hit. The 2014 Godzilla kickstarts the MonsterVerse, which spawns its own sequels and spin-offs. Kong Skull Island is next to be released, followed by Godzilla 2, King of the Monsters, and Godzilla vs. Kong. I liked all of those movies. Gareth Edwards' film is a interesting take on Godzilla. It's a little slow, but it's still pretty good. I liked King of the Monsters and Godzilla vs. Kong. That was a fun movie. It was just balls out action. Didn't go too in-depth with the story or characters, but it was just enjoyable just to watch two cinema icons beating the shit out of each other on screen. Finally, and this is the version of Godzilla vs. Kong I actually did get to see, so I know it's real. Kong Skull Island I didn't like when I first saw it. I had to see it again to like it and get what it was going for. And this year we're spoilt for Godzilla films. We've had Godzilla Minus One, which you already know my opinion of already. And early next year, is it March or April, Godzilla times Kong, The New Empire, which looks pretty good. There's a bad King Kong. Who'd have thought? But either way, even if the story is garbage, the action should be good. So I'm looking forward to that. So that concludes our history of the Godzilla franchise.
Hi guys, I'm Courtney.
And I'm Lisa.
And we are the hosts of The Book of the Dead, a true crime podcast based out of New Jersey, where we tell you about the most obscure cases that you may have never heard of. So join us in the Book of the Dead library for another chapter of The Book of the Dead wherever you get your podcasts. Bye, guys.
So this brings us to the real-life event that helped inspire Godzilla. And it comes from the little-known story of Lucky Dragon number 5. I'd never heard of this story until I did research for this show, so maybe you have heard of it, maybe you haven't. I don't think it's quite a widely known story, unless you are really into atomic history and Godzilla. So Lucky Dragon number 5 was the name of a tuna slash fishing boat that did what every other fishing boat did. It fished. The boat was originally called Dugo Fukuyuri Maru. So the story of the Lucky Dragon number 5 begins in 1954. The boat and the crew had been on many fishing voyages before, but none that would be remembered for their infamy and being in the wrong place at the wrong time. So the Lucky Dragon number 5 set sail on the 22nd of January 1954. The crew set sail for the Midway Sea near the Midway Atoll. They set their nets out and start fishing, but unfortunately, the first bit of the bad luck strikes. They lose their nets and are forced to change direction and head southward towards the Marshall Islands. It's now March the 1st, 1954. Lucky Dragon number 5 is on course for the Marshall Islands. The same time, the US Castle Bravo nuclear test is taking place at the Bikini Atoll. And unbeknownst to the crew, they are headed straight for it. The United States had set out a designated safe zone, which the Lucky Dragon was adhering to. They were fishing outside of the danger zone. They were aware that the tests in the area were going on. Well, they were aware something was happening, whether they knew it was a nuclear test or not. It's a different story. I imagine it would have been pretty top secret. The crew was going about their business, fishing, getting their jobs done, unaware that they were headed straight into the danger zone. The United States detonates a nuclear bomb. Unfortunately for everyone involved, the test was more than twice as powerful as the United States had predicted. It also didn't help that the weather patterns had changed and blew the nuclear fallout straight for the direction of the Lucky Dragon number 5 crew, who were sailing straight into its path. If you've ever seen any of the video on some of those tests, it's pretty incredible. It's hard to believe, almost. I've seen one where the nuke goes off and the blast hits a couple of ships that were anchored miles away. And I always thought, why were they so close? Like, why weren't they kilometers away from the blast? Why did they have to anchor the ships so close to it? Because wouldn't that irradiate the ships and potentially all of the crew or kill some of the crew? But it makes sense now. If they underestimated the power of the bomb, they would have been closer and accidentally anchored way too close to the test site. So that does make sense. I mean, hopefully some people got fired over that, because what are your bomb technicians and developers doing? If they made a bomb and said it was going to be so powerful, then it turned out to be twice as powerful. That's a huge oversight or underestimation to make. And it seems to have caught everybody off by surprise. So the crew crosses the danger zone and heads straight into the wall of radioactive fallout. The fallout is a fine ash of radioactive sand and coral particles. It rains down upon the crew, sticking to the hull and deck of the ship, as well as the crew's clothing and skin. So the crew are obviously panicked by this. They try to get out of the area as quickly as possible, but unfortunately this takes around about 6 hours because they have to retrieve the nets and their fishing gear before they can get out of the area. And this is obviously a time where this stuff would have been really expensive and probably hard to come by in the post-war years. So you can understand why they couldn't just abandon it and turn tail and get out of there. It took 6 hours to collect all the nets and equipment. They also had to clean the fish and put it into storage before they could get out of there. It also exposed their catch of tuna and shark to the radioactive particles as well. Some of the deck crew were covered in this fine ash, inadvertently exposing themselves to the radioactivity. Some of the deck crew scooped up the radioactive dust and placed it into bags, but unfortunately they used their bare hands to do so. One of the crewmen also licked some of the dust. I don't know what he was thinking or why he did this, but he does. His name is Oshi Matasachi. He reports that the dust, it was, quote, like powdered snow, gritty but with no taste. The crew that had been directly exposed to the dust had it sticking all over them. It was stuck to their skin. It was in their eyes, their ears, their nasal passages. It even got in their underwear. It caused irritation of the eyes and nose. After the gear was collected, the ship and the crew get out of the area as quickly as they fucking can. By that night, members of the crew were coming down with radiation sickness. Some of the symptoms were dizziness, nausea, diarrhea, headaches, red itchy eyes that developed a mucus-like substance, and that was only a few hours after exposure. The fishermen called the ash Shinoha, meaning death ash. It was revealed later on that the ash was made up of cesium-137, selenium-141, strontium-90, and uranium-237. So it's pretty nasty stuff. You wouldn't want to get anywhere near it, let alone be covered in it in the form of a fine ash. That would have gone everywhere. It would have gotten your hair. I doubt it would have washed off easily either. One of the crew decides to keep some of the ash so it can be analysed in a lab when they make it back to Japan. He takes a sample of the dust, places it in a pouch, and hangs it in between the bunk beds where the crew sleep. And it kind of goes without saying, but this is not that good of an idea. This would have a further effect on the crew. It's a radioactive material and it's in very close proximity. And when they returned to Japan, it was found out that the dust did in fact come from the hydrogen bomb. That doesn't come as much of a surprise, because coral dust wouldn't have those effects on people. It was pretty clear that it was some type of poisonous substance. The United States government, on the other hand, seemed to be surprised by the findings, or act surprised. They try to keep the nuclear experiments a secret. I have a feeling that those in charge were acting surprised. I don't think it would have come as much of a shock that these guys had this type of reaction after they just detonated a nuclear bomb. If that was to happen today, it would be nearly impossible that anyone or any group would let a government test nuclear weapons in a pristine part of the Pacific Ocean. But back in 1950, this actually happened. Nuclear bombs were detonated in the pristine Pacific Ocean on sparsely populated islands, or islands that didn't have anyone living on them, or that was what the government said. You could not imagine that happening today. It would cause such an outrage, and there'd be protests all around the world. You can't get away with much anymore, so I doubt anyone would even try to do that now. No one's tested nuclear bombs in, well, probably close to 30 years. I think the last ones to do that were the French government off the coast of Queensland, near, well, relatively close proximity to the Great Barrier Reef. Great idea that was. I remember that, seeing that on TV when I was a kid. And in the years following the nuclear tests, there were a lot of lawsuits directed at the United States Navy, or the Air Force, I think it was the Navy, in relation to the test they did in the Bikini Atoll. I saw a documentary on this years ago, and I can't remember if it said that the government directly lied about how many people lived on the island or the effects it would have on people in the immediate vicinity. I don't think that anyone really gave a shit or knew back then the effects and long-term effects of radiation. Because a lot of local people in the inhabited islands around the area came down with similar symptoms, and they had long-lasting effects through multiple generations. Look up blob babies and you'll know what I'm talking about. In the documentary, a group from, I think it's some of the islands around the area, I can't remember which one, they had babies that were severely deformed with no arms and legs, and then were basically just like jelly babies. They took the United States government to court, specifically the Navy, for compensation and environmental damage or something like that. Don't quote me on it. I can't remember the fine details, but it was along those lines. It's now day three, and some of the crew start to develop blisters on their skin that had direct contact with the ash. It was also reported that the skin on their face starts to darken, which is a little weird, I guess. I tend to think of that like a radiation burn or like a sunburn. That makes the most sense to me, but I'm not a nuclear scientist, so what I say probably doesn't really carry a lot of weight. So it's about a week later, and the crew are on their way back to Japan. And in this time, some of the crew's hair starts to fall out. It's now March the 11th, and they're only a day or so away from Japan, where they hit the second piece of bad luck. They encounter some very rough seas, which delays the return journey by 2 days. The ship docks on March the 14th, late in the day. This also contaminates the rest of the fish. I guess the particles probably moved around and made their way down to the storage. The tuna was inspected with a Geiger counter by scientists before it was allowed to be sold to markets and fishmongers, shop owners and restaurant owners. Most of the tuna had to be thrown away because of the radiation levels. I'm going to assume they did the right thing and disposed of it properly and didn't just chuck it away in a dumpster near the dock for stray cats and dogs to eat and spread radiation, if it can be spread, I don't think it can, and leave contaminated bits of tuna all around the docks in the city. I'm assuming they would have. So the men are now home. They're checked over by medical professionals and given the once-over with a Geiger counter. From there, the men are taken straight to Yaesu Public Hospital, where they put in the care of Oi Toshaki. He prescribes them zinc ointment to put onto their burns and onto their faces and sends them home. It's now March the 15th, and the engineer of the Lucky Dragon number 5, Mr. Yamamoto, and the deckhand Masuda, and 5 other of the older men on board are sent to Tokyo University Hospital for treatment. Upon arriving at the hospital, they have blood and bone marrow tests where it's revealed that their white blood cell counts are half the normal level. So a specialist is sent to the hospital, a biophysicist by the name of Nishiwaki Yasushi. He travels all the way from Osaka to examine the crew and the boat. It doesn't take him long to figure out where the problem started. He writes a letter to the chief of the US Atomic Energy Commission, asking for more information about the tests and what the crew were exposed to and the best way to help them. He tells the Atomic Energy Commission the crew are suffering from headaches, burns, pain in the eyes, nausea, bleeding gums, and all the other symptoms of acute radiation poisoning. He receives no response for the United States. However, they do dispatch 2 medical scientists to Japan to study the effects of the fallout on the boat crew. They also assist doctors along the way. This leads the remaining crew to be quarantined at the Yaesu North Hospital, where all their belongings and clothing are seized and disposed of. High concentrations of radiation are found in the men's hair and nails, which results in the rest of the men having their hair shaved. One of the men affected, Oshi Matsuchi, he writes a book and he lays the finger of blame squarely at the United States and the Japanese Foreign Minister, Kasutsu Okazaki. He resents the United States for the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and claims that the US officials sent to investigate and help the doctors treat the men and were more interested in gathering scientific data. And they weren't there on a humanitarian mission to help cure anybody that their bombs had poisoned. He even claims, this is a quote from him, that the foreign minister usually stood on the American side, and it appeared that he was the American foreign minister. So from here, the men are all transferred to Tokyo University Hospital. They stay in hospital for 14 months. Some of the crew that were worse affected stay longer. Each of the men were required to take daily examinations and multiple blood samples. All of the crew involved have their bone marrow tested. And just like the previous tests, the men's white blood cell count has dramatically dropped, which seems to be a recurring symptom. So the drop in the white blood cell count leads to the men having internal bleeding and bloody stool. Not very nice. You can only imagine what these guys have been through in the last couple of months, and Now they have to stay in hospital for 14 months and have daily tests. It would have completely sucked. So next time you're feeling sorry for yourself when you've got a flu and you have to have a couple of days off, remember the crew of the Lucky Dragon number 5. Lucky Dragon number 5 wasn't so lucky. They also have high fevers, bleeding gums and noses, as well as chronic diarrhea. Don't know what would have been worse in that case. Can you imagine how dehydrated these guys would have been? You wouldn't be able to eat anything. Well, you probably could, but you wouldn't be able to keep it down for very long. It would have absolutely sucked. Their sperm counts were also found to be pretty low. A majority of the cases, sperm counts were down, and in some of the extreme cases, some of the men were found to have no sperm count at all. And unfortunately, this was a time where medical knowledge wasn't what it is today. They didn't have a scientific treatment for radiation poisoning or really even know how to tackle a medical issue such as this, hence why the Americans were sent there to gather the research and to help. They were probably just as curious to see what the effects of radiation were. As a much bigger bomb than Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the bombs dropped on Japan in World War II. It's obliterated most of what they touched. But this sounds like it was a more intense, concentrated form of radiation poisoning. And if the bomb was bigger, it was probably a lot higher concentrations of radioactive material. So the doctors in charge prescribed the men large amounts of antibiotics, blood transfusions, and good old-fashioned bed rest in order to cure their symptoms. And it kind of goes without saying that this didn't work very well. One of the doctors involved in the test reported that the men had also developed acute panmyelosis, which is a disease that destroys the bone marrow and its ability to generate blood. So one of the men, Kubayami Akichi, starts to go downhill on the 20th of August. He falls critically ill on August the 29th, where he develops meningitis. He also becomes increasingly violent and delirious and has to be restrained to the bed. He slips into a coma not long after and develops pneumonia. Just when you think he hasn't got enough things wrong with him, he gets pneumonia on top of that. It's about a month later, on the 23rd of December, he passes away due to complications from radiation sickness, making him the first member of the crew to die from exposure to the radioactive material. So in the following year, in 1955, on May the 20th, the remaining 22 men are released from hospital. They get their yearly checkups to monitor the long-term damage done to them by the radiation, but are sent on their merry way. And this is another piece of bad luck for the crew of Lucky Dragon number 5. Unfortunately, they don't qualify for medical care benefits the same way survivors of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings did. I guess because it wasn't during the war and they weren't a civilian population that was bombed, there was no government compensation. And just to add insult to injury, much like some of the survivors of the bombings, they were stigmatized by the Japanese public. They thought radiation poisoning was contagious, and this leads the men to keep their mouth shut and in some cases move from where they were living into rural areas or other parts of Japan to seek a new life and a fresh start. So we're going to have a look at how long these guys lived once they were released from the hospital. They've been struggling with radiation symptoms for many years. So without getting too morbid, we're going to have a quick look at how long these guys lived and see if there's any type of pattern forming. So once they were released from the hospital, the crew of Lucky Dragon number 5 had various luck in their new life. And you might see some patterns forming here. Masayoshi Kawashimi, he starts a new life making pouches, but unfortunately this doesn't go to plan and his business fails. His marriage also breaks down and he gets a divorce. He returns to what he was once good at, and that was fishing. But unfortunately, he dies not too long afterwards. He was only 47 years old. Another member of the crew, Sanjiro Masada, his health runs into another set of bad luck. He contracts various diseases and gets several illnesses over the remainder of his life. He gets stomach ulcers and diabetes. He also gets psoriasis of the liver and sepsis. He dies age 54. Yuichi Masada, he's working in a field where one day he collapses. He is taken to hospital, but dies 10 days later. He also has psoriasis of the liver. He's only 55 years old. I'm not sure if he is related to Sanjiro or not. Shinzo Suzuki, he takes a job as a truck driver. He's driving on an expressway one day when he's involved in a car accident. He is trapped inside his truck and burns to death. Oshi Matasuchi gets in contact with his wife. His wife tells him that her husband had also suffered from psoriasis of the liver and from generalized weakness. He was only 57 years old. Just another one with psoriasis of the liver. There's a pretty obvious pattern forming now. Hiroshi Kasuka, he had attended his regular checkups just like the other members of the crew. He was diagnosed with stomach cancer in March of 1986. And this is only a couple of weeks after having another checkup. He complained of stomach pains. He has about 2/3 of his stomach removed. His recovery was going pretty well. But then about a week later, he develops pneumonia, just like some of the other crew. I don't think he is deceased. I'm pretty sure he's still alive. There's no death date I could find on him. So I think he might be the only remaining member of the crew. Chujo Yamamoto, he was taken to hospital a day before he was meant to go in for his regular checkup. And just like Hiroshi, he is diagnosed with cancer, except he has lung, colon, and liver cancer. Oshi Matasuchi comes and visits Yamamoto in hospital with some of the other crew. He visits him on 21st of February. But as luck would have it, Yamamoto dies of cancer 13 days later on the 6th of March 1987. He was 60 years old. Kenshi Tagaga, he also has liver cancer. He dies at the age of 66. News makes its way back to Oshi. In December of 1989, he rings up his wife, where she informs him that Tagagi was cremated, and at the crematorium, she was told that his bones were the thinnest and most fragile that they had ever seen. Susumi Misaki, after he is released from the hospital, he opens a tofu shop, but like many of the other crew, he also dies of cancer. He gets lung cancer and dies at the age of 92. He's the longest surviving member of the crew, besides the guys that are still alive. 92 is not bad, considering everyone else dies in their late 40s to mid-60s. After his experiences, Oshi is inspired to write a book. He is also a fierce advocate of nuclear disarmament. He also has a child that was stillborn, which he blames on his exposure to the radiation. In 2011, he writes a book called The Day the Sun Rose in the West, Bikini, The Lucky Dragon and I. It's part personal story. It contains the story of the Daigo Fukuro Maru, Lucky Dragon number 5, his own personal story and declassified documents about the Japanese and American government and the damage done by the fallout. And with that, that brings us to an end of the history and influences behind everybody's favourite movie monster, Godzilla.
G'day, g'day, g'day. Don't skip. Let me interrupt the podcast that you're currently listening to with some blatant self-promotion. What do you get when you mix two Aussie mates, a splash of booze, well, more than a splash, and some microphones? You get Cheers Big Ears, hosted by myself, the Chad, and my mate, Matt, and sometimes, but more often than not now, my missus, Bobby. It's a podcast of adult beverages and not-so-adult conversation. It's not serious. Far from it. Well, except for that one episode, but that was just that one. We're available wherever you get your podcast fix. Cheers, Big Ears.
And that concludes our epic look at Godzilla Minus One, the backstory of the Godzilla franchise and history, and the true story of a Lucky Dragon number 5. I hope you learned something. I had no idea about the story of Lucky Dragon number 5 before I started researching this show. It's completely unbelievable. I'm really surprised I've never heard of this story before looking into the backstory of Godzilla. It's one of those unbelievable true stories that you think would be on all of the history and mystery shows, but I've never heard it mentioned on any TV show or read it in any book. I should be back in a couple of weeks with a brand new episode. The next episode has been recorded and is in the process of editing. It should be done pretty soon. We're not going to have a look at June quite yet. We're going to have a look at the 2023 Academy Awards. Then we'll get into an in-depth look and review at June and June Part 2, as well as the backstory behind the mastermind of the June franchise, Mr. Frank Herbert. Then we're going to take a trip back in time and look at one of history's most polarizing and misunderstood figures, the one and only Nostradamus. So definitely stick around for that. And with that, that concludes the show. A big thank you to everyone who listened to the end. If you'd like to support the True Tank, there's a couple of things you can do. Head on over to the Facebook and Instagram page, give it a follow and a like. You can download all your favorite episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, should still be on Podbean, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts, Pandora, iHeartRadio, or wherever else you get your podcasts from. Don't forget the YouTube channel, it's pretty small. I'd like to see if I can get to at least 100 followers by the end of the year. So if you haven't subscribed on YouTube, please go ahead and do so. If you feel so inclined, you can leave a 5-star rating and review. It helps the show grow and get noticed. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell people you work with or anyone else you think might like the show. Word of mouth is still a great way to get things out there. I'll be back in the next couple of weeks with a brand new episode. So until then, I'm the Tank. This is the Truth. May the truth be with you. Thank you.